We're picking up within Genesis chapter 42. And of course, remember last time we went through the whole story about Joseph getting favorable, preferential treatment by his dad. The other brothers were jealous. It seems that God had things in store for Joseph, giving him dreams foretelling that he would be in a position of rulership with his brothers bowing down to him. And he made the perhaps not wisest move of telling them about that, which just made them like him a bit less. So eventually it climaxed in them selling him to a band of, Bedouins or traders. Midianites and Ishmaelites went by, and they, rather than kill him, let's sell him, get a little cash out of the matter. And they brought back the tunic of many colors that they dipped in blood and showed it to Jacob and let him draw the conclusion that Joseph was dead and gone. Of course, he's not dead and gone, and he's going to end up having this amazing future. Doesn't start out so great. He's a steward, becomes a steward in the house of an Egyptian official, as you know. That steward's wife decided that Joseph was one hot commodity that she wanted to enjoy, but he wouldn't listen to her, wouldn't spend time with her, so she framed him and had him thrown in prison. Even there, though, he rises as high as you can while you're in prison. He's in good with the keeper of the prison. He's given special responsibilities. And I suspect, as I said, all along, he's learning skills. He's learning about management and administration and who knows what other things, so that he'll be ready when the time comes. And God will lead him out when the time comes. God gives Pharaoh that bizarre dream about the seven fat cows and then seven thin, gaunt cows. Similar dream with grain. And nobody can interpret it except, the chief butler or cupbearer to the Pharaoh had Joseph interpret his dream 2 years earlier. Also the baker's dream, but the baker wasn't there to tell him what the interpretation was. But he tells Pharaoh, hey, there's this Hebrew in prison who knows how to interpret dreams. Let's bring him in. Now, Joseph does. There's going to be 7 years of great plenty, then 7 years of famine. So if you're smart, you'll get somebody who's wise to oversee gathering food and storing it up during the good years to be ready for the famine. Pharaoh looks at him and says, well, since you figured this all out and you got the plan, you're going to be the guy. In a stunning turnaround, Joseph goes from being in prison as a criminal to being the top official in the country only under Pharaoh. And so he's running things. And we get the story that he successfully does gather up huge amounts of food, so much they leave off trying to keep count of how much there was. They probably built storage buildings all around the land and had an administration set up for when the time would come to start emptying the food back out, which is where we get in chapter 42. Of course, the famine does come. They begin selling grain to the Egyptians, although you got to think the Egyptians probably didn't start starving right away. They probably had a surplus since crops had been so good. They'd probably done some saving on their own, I would think. But even other nations hear of them having food and people start coming in wanting to buy it, including, Jacob and the 11 sons that he still has with him. And remember, we think of, Jacob and 11 guys, there's only a dozen of them. Well, they all have wives, they all have children, grandchildren, they have servants. The clan of Israel, we could say, has already grown substantially. Estimates say there might have been a couple hundred of them, possibly even more. But that's guesstimates. We don't know for certain. Later, we'll see that there are 70 males descended from Jacob, including Jacob. So that's quite a number in just a couple generations. Pick up with verse 6 of chapter 42, because it says, Joseph was governor over all the land. We mentioned that. And it was he who sold to all the people. Okay, so he's in charge. As I said, it's not like he's at a 7-Eleven running the cash register. But he is closely involved. He seems to be an administrator who likes a hands-on approach. And I can't help but wonder if he stationed himself in the area where if someone did come down from the promised land, he'd be there to see them. Whether or not that was his intention, that is exactly what happened. Joseph's brothers came, bowed down before him with their faces to the earth. Well, guess what? Right then and there, the first time he sees them after, what's it been, about... 17, no, he was 17 when they sold him. It's 13 years later because he's 30. No, wait a minute, 37 years later. I forgot the 7 years of plenty. Anyways, his prophetic dream is right here fulfilled as soon as he sees his brothers. You can refer back to Genesis 37. He dreamed that their stocks bowed down to his stock. And they interpreted, what, we're going to bow down to you? Well, here they are doing it. They don't realize who he is. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he acted as a stranger and spoke roughly. And it mentions later that he's speaking through an interpreter. He speaks Egyptian now, probably pretty fluently, but he hasn't forgot how to understand Hebrew, assuming that's whatever dialect they might have been speaking. So he speaks roughly to them. They don't recognize him. How could they not recognize him? He's their brother, right? Or is that a silly question to ask, Julia?
I mean, he looked like an Egyptian. Okay. And they'd never seen him looking like an Egyptian.
How?
Like clean shaven, probably wearing a headdress of some
sort. Okay,
yeah,
the style and fashion. That's it. And one other thing, Nate. Yeah, one of the things, I mean, he's dressed as an Egyptian, he's speaking Egyptian. And the last time they saw him, he was 17 years old. Now he's a middle-aged man. You know, that people change their appearance somewhat. In any case, what I wanted to stop and establish that this is entirely plausible. Now, remember, because he was 17, but they were all significantly older than him, so they probably had reached a mature enough stage that by the time when they sold him into slavery, they looked like they were going to look. You know, they were already, you know, by now I'm sure they look older, but you can see a picture of me when I was 30 and a picture of me now and say, oh, that's the same guy. Whereas if I show you a picture of me when I was 15, you might go, really, that was you? So Joseph recognizes them. They haven't changed that much. Maybe they're grayer, your beard, but they don't have any idea of who he is. And he speaks roughly to them. Does he have reason to be angry and treat them roughly? You bet he does. But we're going to see that he still does care about them. He cares about family. So so he gives them a bad time and he accuses them. He's like, where did you come from? Well, we came to buy food. They didn't recognize him. He says he remembered the dreams. Of course, he's seeing that dream fulfilled. Ah, you're spies. You've come to spy out the land. No, you're servants. We've come to buy food. And then they start telling him things that he already knows, but things maybe they shouldn't have given an opening, you know. So in verse 11, we're one man's sons. We're honest men, not spies. No, but to see the nakedness of the land, you know. Well, and they said, your servants are 12 brothers. So let me tell you about our family. There were 12 of us, but one is with our father back home, and one is no more. Matter of fact, I skipped over something interesting. If you see back in verse 4, of course, Benjamin stayed with Jacob because he said, oh, lest he, you know, lest something bad happen to him. Jacob's worried because he already lost Joseph. And one of the things I find interesting is you'll see it time and again, Benjamin is referred to as the young lad. And you could read this and get the impression, oh, he's just a little kid. He's not. Later we'll find out that he has several kids. He's got more kids than most of them. So he's not a lad. He's a young man probably, you know, but he's been married and I don't remember the exact number, but he's got like half a dozen kids by this point. So I don't think of him in that way, but he's still by far the youngest and he's the favorite of his father. And they let Joseph know, hey, you know, there were 12 of us, one's back home and one is no more. You know, by no more, and they might believe that he's died. They don't know what happened to him after they sold him. And it's worth noting, and I want to check, we know from the next chapter, specifically in chapter 43, verse 7, that this isn't a complete account of their conversation. Because later when they're telling Jacob about it, he says, what in the world did you tell him that you had other brothers for? And they say, well, he asked us. You know, he asked us, do you have any other brothers? Is your father still alive? So, you know, this is an abbreviated form of the conversation, and apparently Joseph wanted to learn if his father was still alive. You know, he noticed there were only, you know, 10 of them there. He's wondering, what about my younger brother? So he asked him about that, and he's probably happy to hear that he is alive, but he wants to see him, so he sets something up. First of all, of course, he throws him in prison. Well, he says first before that, he says, you know, here's the proof that you're not going to be spies. Send someone to bring that brother. He's letting them think that it's just proof that they really are from one family. But he wants to see Benjamin, his full brother, you know, son of his mother and father. So he puts him in prison for 3 days. Then he relents. Or maybe this was his plan all along. We're not sure. He said, do this. I fear God. If you're honest men, let one of your brothers be confined. So instead of only one going back to get Benjamin, I'll keep just one here. All of the rest you go back. Take food for your family and bring the youngest brother to me and it'll be verified and you won't die. And interestingly, in verse 21 then, we see where they go immediately. Why do they think they're suffering? They remember their greatest sin, apparently. They said to one another, "We're truly guilty concerning our brother. We saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we wouldn't hear. Therefore," that's the reason this distress is coming on us. This is important to remember. They don't know it, but Joseph can understand what they're saying. They're speaking in a language that they think he doesn't understand, and they think he wouldn't care, but he understands, and now, if he didn't know it before, which there's no reason to think he would have, he begins to realize that they are sorry for what they did. They understand that they did wrong selling him into slavery. And that's important. It starts to open a door for forgiveness since there's evidence of repentance. Sky?
So they were talking in Egyptian before, right? Not in
No, there's Hebrew, later it mentions Joseph speaking through an interpreter. So it doesn't say it here, but it will in later chapters. So sorry, that's I should have mentioned, and I didn't write down the verse where it specifically tells us. Because when he reveals himself, then he'll say, "Look, I'm speaking to you with my own mouth." So he'll start speaking to them in Hebrew, and you know, and they're probably, well, it'll say they're just amazed. They don't know what to say. So we hear him saying this. Reuben gets in a "I told you so." In verse 22, Reuben says, "Didn't I tell you, don't sin against the boy, and you wouldn't listen? Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us." So they're all sharing this idea that we're suffering in this way because of what we did to Joseph. It says they didn't know that Joseph understood them. Oh, here's where it says it. He spoke to them through an interpreter. So, you know, he'd had somebody standing there interpreting, even though that wouldn't have been necessary, but it helped keep up the ruse that he had. But this had an effect on him. When he realized how they felt, it says he turned away from them and wept. You know, so this really got him emotionally. Oh, they do care. You know, they're upset, they're bothered, they wish they hadn't done it. He'd given them a small taste of what he'd suffered. They were in prison 3 days. He was in prison for years and serving as a slave. So, of course, it says here that he took Simeon. He'd said, "Let one of you stay in prison." He chose which one would stay. He bound Simeon before their eyes. We could ask the question, why Simeon? And it doesn't tell us, so we're just left to guess. One thing we could say is Simeon, being the second to oldest, was the oldest brother that didn't try to save him. Okay, well, remember the incident at Shechem. And later we'll see Jacob refer to that. It doesn't say anything about Levi here, but remember it was Simeon and Levi who let the guys get circumcised, then when they were sore, went in and slaughtered them all. Simeon seems to have been a bad dude, kind of mean. And maybe he'd picked on Joseph especially. I'm insinuating or guessing a little bit, but you know, Simeon, you know, maybe Joseph had especially suffered at the hands of Simeon. I'm saying maybe, but he's the one he puts in prison. And then he gives a command: fill their sacks with grain. So give them all the grain they wanted, but restore each man's money, and don't tell them you're doing it. It doesn't say that, but it's obvious that's what happened. They loaded their donkeys with grain and departed. And one of them opened his sack to give his donkey feed at the encampment and saw there was money in the mouth of his sack. So he said, "My money's been restored. Here it is in my sack." And what does that do to them? Their hearts fail. I mean, basically, you ever feel that feeling in the pit of your stomach like something's dropping? Oh, no. It's like, we're in bigger trouble. Something bad is happening. And they say, "What has God done to us?" It's interesting. Apparently, the money was put back in the sacks of all of them. But it only shows one finding it. We don't know if they just didn't mention it here or it was in the bottom of the other sacks, or, and that's a detail that doesn't matter that much. Speaking of which, I put in my notes, I can't remember where I came across this. One commentary made the point that the Hebrew word for sack is sack. But it makes you wonder if the Hebrew word is somehow, or the English word is somehow derived from Hebrew. And like I said, I didn't get that myself. So I thought it was kind of funny. Anyways, starting in verse 29, I'm summarizing here, I hope you don't mind, but It's not tedious to read, but it's longer. They went to Jacob, their father, and told him all that happened. They said, the man who is lord of the land spoke roughly to us, took us for spies. And we told him, you know, we're not spies, 12 brothers. One's with our father, one is no more. And then the man said, this is how I'll prove you. Bring your youngest brother. Well, Jacob's not happy about this. He's like, what in the world did you tell him that stuff for? Yeah, in verse 36, Jacob said, you've bereaved me. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. And you want to take Benjamin? All these things are against me. It's interesting how he thinks Joseph is dead. Now he's saying Simeon is no more. Jacob seems to think that Simeon is just as much lost to him as Joseph was. You know, Jacob's not holding much hope that he's ever going to see him again. Yeah, Emily?
How long would all of this have taken, the journey back to go get Benjamin? And then it's like, how long was Simeon probably like in prison
Well,
for?
It said basically, it'll tell us later in the story, they wait a year till, it seems they bought a year's supply of food. I think it's the beginning of chapter 43, where it came to pass when they'd eaten the food. Oh no, it's later on when Joseph tells them there have been 2 years of famine and there's 5 years left. So it'll come out later, and so we interpret it to think they probably bought a year's supply. And Jacob didn't say anything about going to get more food until they were running out of food. I was going to mention, you might wonder, it's like, wow, what's Joseph doing? Is he a bad manager? Here he's just giving them the grain and giving them back their money. It's worth noting, he has that authority. He's in the position where that's under his authority. He could decide to give grain away for free or at half price or whatever. So I've never come across anything, any study of this that concludes that Joseph was doing something illegal or wrong, but it would have been wrong for his servants to do it without him knowing. In any event, of course, they had no idea. They don't realize, you know, why would they think this guy that's speaking harshly to them is giving them back their money? They're jumping back to the conclusion that, oh, God is out to get us and he's setting us up for a fall. In verse 37, you know, when Jacob doesn't want to let him take Benjamin back, remember, Benjamin's not the little boy we imagine, but he's still the youngest and the favorite. Reuben said, kill my two sons if I don't bring him back to you, and I'll bring him back. So I don't think Reuben is suggesting that he kill his sons, but he's saying, I'll take as good a care of Benjamin as if he were my own son. So he's saying, it's going to be that important. I'll take care of him like my own so that, you know, he'll be as safe as my children would, and the only way he'd die is if something would happen that would kill them. But Jacob still, no way. My son's not going down with you. And then the next verse, the famine's still in the land, we might think, well, he changed his mind awful quick, but it seems some time has passed, and being hungry will make you do things. I mean, I know all of us had a fast not that long ago, and you know, you get pretty hungry. You know, imagine if you're going hungry not because you're choosing to fast, but because you're running out of food and there's no food to be found. It'll make you change your opinion on things. So he says, go back to Egypt, buy us a little food. By little, probably a whole year's worth. Judah spoke to him, saying, reminding him. So here we see Judah taking the lead, and we'll see it time and again. The man warned us, you're not going to see my face unless your brother is with you. If you send our brother, we'll go. If you won't send him, we're not going to go. Basically, there's no point. He was pretty clear on what he wanted. Here's where Israel said, why did you deal wrongfully to even tell him you had another brother? Well, they said he asked us, is your father alive? Do you have another brother? You know, how in the world would we know? He'd say, bring him back. So Judah, here still taking the lead, Judah said to Israel, his father, send the lad with me. I'll take personal responsibility, and we'll arise and go that we may live and not die, you and our little ones. He says, I myself will be surety for him. From my hand you'll require him if I don't bring him back. You know, if we hadn't lingered, we could have been there and back by now. Yeah, here's where we see a significant contrast from Judah's earlier behavior. Remember, Judah was the one who had suggested selling Joseph. Judah was the one who had tried to defraud Tamar, you know, not giving her to the next son. You know, he'd separated from the family. For some reason, he left them, married a Canaanite, was living a separate life. Now he's back, and he seems to be a different person. He's saying, look, I'll put myself in his place. You know, I'm giving my life as collateral. So, you know, you could say he's just talking big, but we'll see him follow this up later. And the point I'm making is Judah seems to have matured spiritually and emotionally in other ways and grown through this. And perhaps he has now devoted himself to worshiping God in the way he hadn't before. Oh, here's where I've got the note. Our calculations are that Benjamin was somewhere between 24 and 30 years old, even though he's still called the lad here. Yeah, starting in verse 11, we see Israel giving them advice. Okay, go down, take a present for the man. And this has been a custom, you know, when you're visiting someone important, to bring what you would call a token gift. And here he says some of the things that may be the best from, you know, the land of Canaan. The Canaan has some of the best stuff. A little balm, a little honey, spices and myrrh, pistachio nuts and almonds. So it's like, take something that's especially good from our region. It's sort of like if you visit Georgia in the summer, you might buy some peaches. Or if you go up to Canada, if you visit Toronto this time of year, you might buy some maple syrup, or any time of year. You know, each area might be known for something that it produces better than other people. And so it's not that these things were so valuable, but take the best that we have to offer, and it's still a token. It's not worth, you know, all the grain they're trying to get. But he also says, take double money. It might have been an oversight that they gave you back your money, so take the money to pay for last year's grain, take other money to pay for the stuff you want to get. And in verse 14, and may God Almighty give you mercy. Oh, he also says before that, take your brother also. And may you release your other brother. He doesn't name Simeon by name. And Benjamin, and if I'm bereaved, I'm bereaved. In other words, we're in such a bad state, I'm going to have to take this chance and risk what happens. And it was smart for them to take double the money. Like I said, it could have been an accident. It's an example for us. You know, if you buy something and they give you the wrong change back, you know, the right thing to do is say, hey, you know, you gave me too much. You gave me a 20 when you should have gave me a 5. This is on a different scale, but it's just being honest, like I said, doing the right thing. When they arrive, we skipped the journey, but in verse 15, they took that present and Benjamin, took double money, went to Egypt, and they stood before Joseph. So, zoom, here we are again. Again, they think Joseph is just the Egyptian governor, but he sees Benjamin with them, and he recognizes him. It's obvious, you know. And he hasn't seen Benjamin since Benjamin was quite a bit younger, but I'm guessing they look enough alike. As I said, they're full brothers rather than half-brothers. So he has a plan right then. He talks to his steward, says, take these men to my home and slaughter an animal and make ready. Which is a slaughter an animal seems odd to us, but it's like, take them home and fix a nice meal and get it ready. They're going to eat with me today. That's something unusual. And by the way, the steward of his house would have been Joseph's top servant. Interestingly, I think it's sort of ironic that that's the same position that he served for Potiphar. So Joseph had been a chief servant, a steward of the house. Now he has someone doing that job for him. Maybe he's a little more understanding. But being taken to Joseph's house, they recognize this is different treatment. Not everybody coming to buy grain is invited back to the boss's house for lunch. And so they're actually worried about it. Verse 18, they're afraid they're brought there because they said, well, it's because of our money. He knows we were the guys that didn't pay, and he's out to get us. You know, he's going to make a case against us, seize us as slaves and our donkeys. I've read that a lot of times, and it always makes me laugh. It's like, when you're about to be enslaved, why do you care about your donkey? But it was probably a sizable herd. If they're carrying enough grain for a year for a clan of maybe 200 people, it's quite a few donkeys. And I've read various sources, you know, studying the history at that time, and they say donkeys were of a special value because they were so versatile. One place I read said that a donkey was like the pickup truck of the Middle East. So imagine if you're going somewhere and you've got a fleet of pickup trucks to haul stuff, you'd be concerned what happened to your fleet of pickup trucks. And maybe I'm the only one that ever read this and thought it seemed odd, but now you'll think about it too. You won't be able to not, right? Okay, so they're a little concerned. Joseph draws near, and the first thing they do is they address the thing about the money. Oh, we came down the first time to buy money. It happened at the encampment. Each man's money. Oh, let me correct that. Not Joseph, but the steward. So they want to address it even before Joseph gets there. You know, we found our money in our sack. But we've brought other money and that money. Verse 22 says, we do not know who put our money in our sacks. Turns out the steward knows. He says, "Peace be with you, don't be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money." And he brought Simeon out. He's being a little bit deceptive, but he is telling the truth. He did have their money. They gave it to him, and then he put it back. We could say because of God's influence. Now, I don't want to do flips and twists to make it imply that this guy would never tell a lie, because he could have. Obviously, he and Joseph are working together to make the brothers think something that's not quite true. But as I said, it is God's influence to provide for them. So he had the money, put it back. Simeon is now brought out. There's no reason to think that Simeon was mistreated, but he was still in prison a whole year. So whatever kind of bad seed Simeon was before, he's probably been humbled a little bit by now. So maybe he's going to have a different attitude. Anyways, they brought him out. They wash their feet, feed the donkeys. Washing feet, I'm sure you've heard about this before. They're in a society where it's kind of dusty and they don't have socks. They're wearing sandals. So in that society, washing, giving you the opportunity to wash your feet when you come in is a standard thing. Kind of like if someone comes to your house for dinner, you'd give them the opportunity to wash their hands. Sorry, I'm stopping to laugh because of last night at dinner. Sue always tells Connor, go wash your hands. We sit down and we're holding hands to pray, and she looks and says, "You didn't wash your hands. These are filthy. Go in and wash your hands." I doubt that anybody was inspecting these guys' feet to make them do it, but it's a courtesy to let them do that. Joseph comes in, also says they made ready the present. So the special balm, pistachios, almonds, honey, they get it out, and they've got a nice gift bag and that stuffing paper and maybe gift wrap. I don't know what they had, but they make it look as nice and presentable as possible. They want to give a good impression. And they come in, they bow down before him, once again fulfilling the dream that Joseph had. And right off, "How are you? Are you well, your well-being? What about the old man?" You know, the man of whom you spoke. He wants to know if his father is still alive, because Jacob's not a young man at this point, and he's already lived a pretty rough life. But they assure him in verse 28, "Your servant, our father, is in good health. He's still alive." Verse 29, "Lifted his eyes and saw Benjamin, his brother. This is your younger brother of whom you spoke," and pronounces a blessing on Benjamin. "God be gracious," and his heart yearned for him. Joseph is not such a hard, crusty guy as it seems. He's a bit of a softy inside, and he knows he's about to break out crying, weeping for joy because he's seeing his brother. So he quickly excuses himself to go into another room and has a good sob, and then he cleans up his face to come back and says, "Put on the food." Yeah, serve the bread, which bread often is a term just for a food in general. It's not like they were only eating dry bread, no butter allowed. You know, they're having a nice meal. And they said, him a place by himself, them by themselves, the Egyptians who ate by them, because the Egyptians could not eat with the Hebrews, because that's an abomination to an Egyptian. Oh, boy, those Egyptians are pretty finicky. Now, I'll point out, this. I've read this a lot of times where I say, well, there's three tables, and this seems kind of odd. There are 11 guys sitting at one table, the Egyptians over here, and here's Joseph. Nobody's willing to eat with him. But it might not have been quite so obvious. You know, you've been at a lot of banquet meals probably where there's round tables and there's 6 to 8 people at each one. There might have been several tables, and it made sense for the brothers to be together. Made sense for the Egyptian servants to be at other tables. And as the leader with the prominence, Joseph being on his own wouldn't be so unusual. Later on, they'd understand what was going on. Now, I don't know. It's interesting that we've got this reference that the Egyptians think it's an abomination to eat with Hebrews. I've seen some speculation that it might have been any foreigners they didn't want to eat with, but we don't have a substantiation for that. Along with this, we can wonder, you know, Joseph is happy to see Benjamin, even cries, but there's no indication so far of if or when, if ever, he plans to reveal his true identity. You know, I've wondered, and I still wonder, when did it dawn on him to let him know? You know, I tend to think maybe he was going to scheme to have Benjamin stay, eventually reveal who he was to him, but have the rest of the family never know. But that's just guesswork right now. He does embarrass Benjamin a little bit, because he sends food out to all the tables. Yeah, we're here towards the end of chapter 43. And they sat them according to their birthplace, the oldest down to the youngest. He sent them out, and they were astonished because when he sent servings, Benjamin's was five times more than the others. It would be customary to send a larger portion to a guest of honor, but they're probably looking saying, he's the kid, you know, and he's not a kid, but they're sending him five times as much. You know, well, Joseph just wanted to honor his brother, he was, you know, that he felt close to. I imagine Benjamin looking around going, what's going on here? Am I supposed to eat all this? So anyways, he commanded the steward of the house, fill the man's sacks with food, as much as they can carry. So give them all the food they want and put the money back again. So he's going to do the same thing he did before. And of course, they'll be scared again and wondering. But he does something else. Also put my cup, the silver cup, and the mouth of the sack of the youngest with his grain money. So he did so. In the morning dawn, the men were sent away. So, you know, I didn't read the last phrase of chapter 43, that they ate and were merry. So after all their fears, nothing bad is happening. They're just having a good meal. And it's like, oh, things are good. The next morning, they get all their grain. They're heading home. Simeon's going with them. Benjamin's going with them. We're in the clear. Life is great. Except they hadn't gone very far. When Joseph sends his steward, who already knows what's happened, get up and follow the men and overtake them and say, why have you repaid evil for good? Is not this the one from which my Lord drinks? And it's referring to the cup. It must have been very distinctive looking, probably a silver goblet or something, so that when anybody saw it, they'd know that's the one Joseph drinks out of. Sort of like if any of you were leaving and your book bag had this in it, and you look in, people would say, that's Dunkel's cup. What are you doing with that? You know, Benjamin knows he didn't take it. And this is where it gets interesting. Well, a lot of it's interesting, but so he does. And I'm sure the steward has soldiers with him. They run him down, they stop him, and they say, why have you done this? You know, he says, it mentions practicing divination, which, I think that's part of the ruse. Joseph, from everything we see, worship the true God. He didn't practice astrology or fortune-telling or seances or any kind of weird stuff. I think what he was doing is he was playing on what the brothers would have thought of an Egyptian pagan who didn't know the true God. So I doubt that Joseph really did divination, which means like soothsaying, fortune-telling, or whatever, using this cup. But the brothers would have easily believed that. So he sort of leaves that implication to show why it's so special to him. I just wanted to address that. Let's not think that Joseph had lapsed into paganism. There's not any other indication of that. And they're saying, and I like that they make the point, look, we came back and brought money from a year ago, you know, because somehow it ended up. So if we're going to do that, why would we steal gold or silver? You know, we brought back enough money to buy a half a dozen of those cups. What makes you think we're going to steal from this guy? But either way, they stop and they unload, and they find all the money in their sacks. Now they're getting a little worried. I'm skipping over some things. Yeah, in verse 9, they say, with whomever of your servants is found, let him die, and we'll all be my Lord's slaves. So they're so confident, because each one of them is saying, I didn't steal it. Did you steal it? They're all saying, no, we didn't steal it. He's got it wrong. We're so certain we didn't steal it. You find it in one of our sacks, you can kill that guy, and all the rest of us will be your slaves. We're that sure. But the guy says, no, I'm not going to kill anybody. I don't want you all as slaves, but whoever we find the cup with, he's going to become a slave. He says that because he knows exactly who has the cup, and it's the one guy Joseph wants to bring back. He wants his full brother Benjamin to come and stay with him. So, verse 11, each man speedily let down a sack to the ground, opened it up. They started with the oldest and left off with the youngest, and they found the cup in Benjamin's sack. Imagine they're looking at him again, really? But then again, maybe not. Because I think each one of them opens it up and there's the money. I'm sure they're each thinking, I didn't take that money. Something happened to put that money there. So when they see the cup in Benjamin's sack, knowing they didn't steal the money, it might be easy to think, something's going on here. We trust Benjamin. Do you see what I'm getting at? And here's the difference. The brothers of 20 years earlier probably would have said, you dummy, Benjamin, you stole it. I think they've matured enough now that they're not, they probably don't think he stole it. And they do something interesting. They tore their clothes. That's not so interesting. Well, could be, but each man loaded his donkey and returned to the city. So they all load up and say, we're all going back. Again, a fair bit of change. You know, the brothers from 20 years ago would have let Benjamin go. Sorry, you got to be a slave. We're heading home to see our wives and kids. But no, they all say, we're all sharing the fate. We're sticking together. We're not going to let anything happen like happened to when we did wrong to Joseph. And of course, then Joseph continues the ruse about divination. Judah and his brothers came to Joseph, fell before him. Joseph said, what indeed have you done? Didn't you know that a man like I could practice divination? So he doesn't say he does. He says, a man like I. And here, as I've been trying to point out, we see Judah take the lead. Judah speaks for the others. What shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? How can we clear ourselves? Look, you know, there's nothing we can say to make this better. And he says, God has found out the iniquity of your servants. And it seems to be, once again, referring back to knowing that they'd done a great wrong many years ago when they sold their brother into slavery. And he says, okay, we're your slaves, both we and he with whom the cup was found. So they're saying, again, we're not leaving Benjamin to suffer for this. We're all going to share the blame. Joseph doesn't want that. You know, far be it from me. The man in whose cup hand the cup is, he'll be my slave. You go in peace to your father. Judah takes it a step further. And I think, well, remember that Joseph knew probably that Judah was the one that said, let's sell Joseph. Judah was a ringleader in what happened bad to Joseph, but now he's changed. And Judas came near and makes a very moving, emotional speech to him. Oh, Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's hearing. Don't let your anger burn. You're even like Pharaoh. You know, my Lord, meaning Joseph, you asked his about, do you have a father or a brother? And we said, yeah, we have our father, an old man, and a child of his old age who's young, relatively speaking. His brother is dead, which wasn't true, but they thought he was. And he alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him. You said, bring him down to me that I might set my eyes on him. We said, no, we can't. If the lad leaves his father, the father would die. And basically he says, you forced us. Verse 24, so it was when we went up to your servant, my father, we told the words, and our father said, go buy us a little food, and we said, we can't. Verse 27, then your servant, my father, said, you know my wife bore me two sons, and one went out for me, and I said, surely he's torn to pieces. I haven't seen him since. If you take this one from me and calamity befalls him, you'll bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave. So he's quoting Jacob here. Now this is Judah speaking in verse 30. Now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad isn't with us, since his life is bound up with the lad's life, it'll happen that he sees the lad not with us, he'll die. So we'll bring down his gray hairs. And verse 32, your servant became surety. So Judah is saying, me, I became surety. I became the collateral. I put my life on the line for taking Benjamin. If I don't bring him back to you, I'll bear the blame forever. Now therefore, please let your servant, meaning me, Judah, let me remain instead of the lad as a slave to my Lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how can I go to my father if the lad is not with me? Lest perhaps he see the evil that would come on my father. I read all that, and I'm sure in the original Hebrew with the inflection that Judah had, it was much more moving. But again, think of the change that he'd had. Judah had formally left his family. And again, we don't know why, but he's the one that suggested selling Joseph and getting some money from it. But now he's willing to be a slave himself. So rather than give up one of his brothers, he's willing to sacrifice for his brother and for his dad. You know, so he's no longer, remember, they were jealous of Joseph. Oh, Joseph gets a special treatment. He's having these dreams. We got to get rid of him. Well, Benjamin's the favorite now. They could have been jealous. But instead, he's adopted the care that Jacob has, in a sense. He's dad's favorite. I respect that. I'm willing to sacrifice, you know, the rest of my life to take care of him. And again, I hope any of us might do the same. I don't know. I've never been in that position. I hope I never am. But the point I want to make is how much Judah has changed from earlier. And we just get little hints of it. It's sort of a parallel, though, with Jacob. I made a point of how Jacob changed. We saw him as a young man, even as a child, all the way to an old man who's gone from trying to do everything on his own, from cheating and swindling, to trusting God for everything. I think Judah's had a parallel trajectory. And it's one that we hope we see much of in this world, even in our own lives. Hopefully we didn't start off selling slaves or things like that, but hopefully all of us mature and become closer to God as we would want. Okay, now, it's worth noting there could have been no chapter break here. Matter of fact, you could go chapter 43 through 46 and have it be one really long chapter, but you'd be reading and say, man, is this chapter ever going to stop? So it's broken up, but it's one continuous story. So Joseph hears this from Judah, and he's moved. He couldn't restrain himself anymore for those who stood, and he cried out, everyone out of here. Basically, he's talking to his Egyptian servants. Maybe he spoke in an Egyptian. Okay, everyone get out of here, and the brothers don't understand Egyptian, so they're, what's going on? Emily?
So earlier you were saying it's a possibility that he actually wasn't planning on revealing himself to them and that like maybe he just wanted Benjamin to stay there with him?
I kind of lean that way, and I can't prove it either way. There's nothing that tells us exactly what he had planned. But if that's his plan, he changes his mind here and now. So get out of here. And he wept aloud. Remember before when he had the yearning, he slipped into another room to cry in private, but he just can't hold it back. And he doesn't want his servants to see him, so he orders them out, but he's there with his brothers. And he wept aloud. And even though he sent him out, it says the Egyptians could hear it. So this is some pretty, it's not just a tear running down. Sorry, that just made me think of something. When we were in North Carolina, we went to this Cherokee, and they had this big statue. I don't know if you girls, if you went over there. But there was a big statue of a Cherokee Indian, and it showed some tears coming down his eyes. And it brought back a memory of when I was a kid. As a matter of fact, I remember seeing this even before we came to church, because I used to watch Saturday morning cartoons. But there was this famous commercial trying to get people to stop polluting. And it showed this American Indian riding along, looking at the beautiful landscape. And then he sees people throwing trash out of cars and polluted rivers. And there's a close-up, and there's a tear coming down his eye. You know, the crying Indian. Well, yeah, and I was making the case, this isn't that. This isn't a single tear of someone who's moved. This is somebody who just can't control it. He's sobbing loud enough for people in the next room. You guys, Google crying Indian sometime, you'll see. I didn't just make up that weird stuff. And Joseph said to his brother, first of all, verse 3, Joseph said to his brothers, I'm Joseph. Does my father still live? Which I've always thought a little odd because he's asked him several times and they said he was alive, but I wonder if the Hebrew, and I haven't studied into it, if it might be, I'm Joseph, you know, my father is my, does my father really still live? Or I can't believe that he still lives. I'm not sure if he's really asking the question, but it doesn't matter. He's acknowledging, hey, your father is my father. I'm your brother. And it says they were dismayed at his presence. I imagine they're going, what do you mean you're Joseph? You know, how could that be? We sold him as a slave when he was 17 years old. Nobody's seen or heard anything from him. We figured he was dead. So Joseph gives them proof. He said, come near to me. So they came near. He said, I'm Joseph, your brother whom you sold into Egypt. They haven't told anybody that. Only those 10 guys would have known. I say 10, I'm not sure if Benjamin would have known or not. So the fact that he knows what they did is evidence. You know, how could some guy in Egypt know that? I'm Joseph, your brother. Now, don't be grieved or angry with yourselves. You sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. He's going to tell them something in more words that he'll say more concisely later. I'm sorry, I've got it in my notes. It's in chapter 50, verse 20. I know I had to hear somewhere. And there's where he says, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. And we'll cover that again later, but so he's saying, basically, you did something bad to me, but God turned it around for good. Now, don't be grieved or angry. You know, God sent me here to preserve life. For these 2 years, the famine has been in the land. There are still 5 years yet. And I mentioned earlier, that's what leads us to think that, okay, they've come to buy food 2 times, maybe at the end of each year of famine. But that's still not an absolute certainty. This is, God sent me before you to preserve a posterity. So it wasn't you who sent me here, but God. He's made me a father to Pharaoh and a lord of all his house. Well, what an attitude for Joseph. You know, you think of Romans 8:28, right? All things work together for good to those who love God. We know that, but sometimes it kind of slips out of our mind because we're suffering. Joseph had gone through a lot of suffering, and he's a big enough person to say, it worked out for good and for your good, even though you did bad. So he says, go down to my father and tell him, your son Joseph, God has made lord of all Egypt, and you'll... And it's, come here, dwell on the land. You can dwell in Goshen, which we'll talk about more later. Your flocks and herds, and I'll provide for you, because there's still five more years of famine. I wanted to get to verse 12, because he says, behold, your eyes and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see that it is with my mouth that speaks to you. So a couple more proofs that he could really be Joseph. One is like, okay, I'm speaking to you in Hebrew, you know, which, how could I know that? And here he mentions that his brother Benjamin, you know, okay, he's his brother in a way the others aren't, because the others are really half-brothers. They all have the same father, but only Benjamin had the same father and mother. But who else outside of the family would have known that? So again, Joseph is making it just so that you have to believe me. As bizarre and amazing as it is, this is the truth. I was mentioning how God turned things around, the Romans 8:28 factor. It's worth noting and put in your mind that it's not hard to draw some parallels between Joseph and Jesus Christ, and that both of them suffered undeservedly. Now, Jesus Christ, of course, suffered for our sins. Joseph, not that he had never earned any suffering, but he didn't do anything to deserve being sold as a slave. But both of them maintained their faith and trust in God. Of course, Jesus Christ in a perfect way. And both of them were later raised to a high position. You know, Jesus Christ, obviously, way higher. But as I said, you see those parallels, which is cool, because then we can look at that and say, okay, if I'm ever in a bad position, maybe I should try to make my life parallel. Endure the frustration. Maybe if I'm suffering and I know I didn't do something to deserve it, I'll take it cheerfully. And, you know, I'll maintain my faith in God, and I'll hope the last part comes true. And we know eventually, at least when Christ returns and resurrects his saints, we do have hope of being raised to high station then. So, any questions or thoughts? So let's take a break for 10 minutes, and we'll come back and we'll go again and see how far we can get in this story.